You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of the June 2025 cover story, A Study in Scarlet, by David Canfield, with photographs by Lachlan Bailey, styled by Geraldine Salio. This dynamic fed into a period of professional dissatisfaction for Johansson, in part why she'd considered directing so strongly. After Lost in Translation, every role that I was offered for years was the girlfriend, the other woman, a sex object. I couldn't get out of the cycle, she says. It sort of felt like, oh, I guess this is my identity now as an actor. There wasn't much I could do with that. Her representatives at the time did not help. They were reacting to the norm, she says. The industry worked like that forever. But it's especially hard to navigate when this treatment coincides with the shift into adulthood. You come into your sexuality and your desirability as part of your growth, and it's exciting to blossom into yourself. You're wearing the clothes you want, you're expressing yourself. Then you suddenly turn around and you're like, wait, I feel like I'm being, I don't want to say exploited because it's such a severe word. I tell her the word doesn't sound wrong to me. Johansson nods. That term is so heavy. But yeah, it was a kind of an exploitation. Once someone is successful, it's easy to think they were always successful. But she overcame more than anyone realizes to get to where she is, Jost tells me via email. She doesn't lose sight of that when considering what other people are going through. Two 2010 projects transformed her career. The aforementioned A View from the Bridge play, for which Johansson won a Tony Award, and Iron Man 2, which turned her into a bona fide movie star. But Johansson was not the first choice to play Natasha Romanoff, also known as Black Widow. Emily Blunt was offered the role. It felt like everything was aligning, and then it didn't happen, and I was really devastated by it, Johansson says. Later, when Blunt had to decline the part because of a conflict, Johansson got what she dubs the best call ever. I remember Scarlett's camera test, like it was yesterday, Downey tells me. She leaned into the Black Widow vibe, and we were transfixed. There was this confident stillness and fierce quietness. I'd never seen anything like it. Then we'd call cut, and she'd flip back into her funny, accessible self, like an on-off mega-charisma switch. Johansson went on to star in the Avengers films as the MCU's most prominent female cast member before bidding farewell with Black Widow. Even though folks like Downey and Chris Hemsworth are making their way back in various forms for Avengers Doomsday, Johansson really meant goodbye. It would be very hard for me to understand in what capacity returning would make sense for me, for the character that I play, she says. I miss my buddies and really would love to be with them forever. But what works about the character is that her story is complete. I don't want to mess with that. For fans, too, it's important for them. Johansson never got trapped in the blockbuster box anyway. She started her production company in 2017. She gave a magnetically unsettling performance in Jonathan Glazer's avant-garde thriller Under the Skin, then pulled off those two Oscar noms for Marriage Story and Jojo Rabbit in the same year. Jost says the latter affected him more than any of her performances in the 8 years they've been together. Her real-life charm comes through in that movie in a way I hadn't seen before. I don't know if anyone else could have pulled off that role in the same way. It's special. This period also necessitated some huge learning experiences, Johansson says. In 2018, she was preparing to play a trans man in a movie called Rub and Tug and held firm after backlash before later dropping out. Sometimes it's better just to listen, she says. The film never got made with another actor either, which disappointed her. She suggests that the character's identity, a criminal with a dark past, was too thorny for Hollywood. It was like, we should still make this film with the right cast. But it didn't seem possible without really angering someone. It's unfortunate because those stories should be told. They need to be told. With Marriage Story, she'd started filming just after divorcing her second husband, Romain Dariac, with whom she shares a daughter. She had a child, her second, with Jost in 2021. I'd check in with her as I was writing, and we would hang out and have these long talks about our own experiences and the emotional world of divorce and how it changed us. Director Noah Baumbach tells me, the work shows. Johansson has never been so raw on camera, but as she made the campaigning rounds, she was rankled by the lack of recognition for her third 2019 film, Avengers Endgame. Johansson takes her craft seriously and thinks commercial viability should not hinder a movie's reputation. How did this film not get nominated for an Oscar, she says, referring to the Best Picture category. Endgame was nominated for its visual effects. It was an impossible movie that should not have worked, that really works as a film, and also it's one of the most successful films of all time. Jurassic World Rebirth ought to be Johansson's next box office smash, based on how the franchise's last few movies have performed. Making the film tested Johansson to trust her instincts, a frequent struggle for her. On the final days of production, she was shooting the introductory scene for her character Zora, a covert ops expert. The setup in Brooklyn was hectic. Zora gets into a car and meets the man trying to recruit her to locate valuable genetic material at the site of a research facility in the original Jurassic Park. Zora only agrees after getting out of the car and being promised a hefty sum. Each take required circling the block in real gridlock traffic. Once the scene ends, we have 10 minutes of driving around in bumper-to-bumper traffic to get us back to the setup point, and it's just so long in between each take that you can't get any momentum, she says. Amid the chaos, director Gareth Edwards asked that Johansson play the scene more inscrutably, as she remembers it, and she didn't agree. Still, she tried adjusting herself to meet the direction. 30 minutes go by, and I'm doing this again, and I'm looking at the floor, and I'm like, no, no, this is not right. This feels wrong. Luckily, she had those earlier takes in the can. As we speak, neither Johansson nor I have seen any footage yet, so we decide to talk again once we have. We walk another 20 or so minutes before splitting off somewhere in Manhattan. Weeks later, we catch up. The blanket of unease that Johansson described when I first met her is worse, if anything, with the president's extreme initial tariff plan just announced. It's really scary, she says over Zoom. The unease remains. Johansson has now watched a handful of scenes while completing post-production audio work and flown to Las Vegas for a rousing presentation of film footage at CinemaCon. I also get a glimpse of unfinished snippets on the Universal lot, including that tricky car scene. My guess is they used one of those early takes. The Zora we meet in the scene is cool, collected, and clear about what she wants. She's smart. She's a leader. She takes no bullshit. If nothing else, Johansson herself is certainly coming through in the role. "I thought of you, actually," she says, after her own viewing seemed to confirm the use of an initial take. "I was happy. I'm so glad." The rebirth reel, screened for me, felt like a spirited, transporting throwback, stuffed with Steven Spielberg homages while propelled by a true sense of adventure that gets lost in most IP sequels. Also, it's a little goofy. The script is by David Koepp, who wrote the original Jurassic Park and hasn't contributed to the film franchise since the 90s. Edwards, the director, is an avowed Spielberg acolyte. The film takes gorgeous, sometimes terrifying advantage of shooting in Thailand, not that they had a choice. They're building floors in the rainforest and bringing in electricity and all the comfort stations for people, and then they have to pack everything out and leave it untouched. But we shot in monsoon season, so then a flash flood would wash half the set away, Johansson says. Shooting in a monsoon is not ideal. She later watched the Thailand set edition of The White Lotus with envy. "I was like, that's when to do it. Different season." Johansson's co-star, Mahershala Ali, found her to be a calming presence amid the hairy conditions. It may take you 4 months in 3 different countries to complete a scene, and none of that was shocking to her. "But for me, that was jarring, if I'm totally honest," says the 2-time Oscar winner. As you begin to respond or freak out to certain ask or to the reality of shooting something that big, you can look at Scarlett and see how grounded she is. I could feel her experience. Rebirth, which hits theaters on July 2nd, is set 5 years after Jurassic World Dominion. It turns out that the island that's home to the research facility, where Johansson and company are left stranded, is also home to dangerous, failed dino experiments. Johansson is thrilled with what she's seen so far. And why not? She's been trying to get cast in a Jurassic movie for more than a decade. She loves the property and believes in the enduring potential of franchises. Terminator 2 is one of the best movies ever made, she says, admiring fresh ideas and great nostalgic elements that play well together. It's about mindfulness and not being lazy. There's something to Rebirth and Eleanor the Great hitting theaters in the same year for Johansson. Both fulfill near lifelong goals and demonstrate what her decades in the business have yielded. In the former's case, a seamless transition as the new face of a billion-dollar franchise, and in the latter's, running her first feature set as if it's her 20th. The leader was always Scarlett, Squibb says. Both also speak to a nostalgic style of filmmaking that Johansson tends to circle around. As she gets deeper into making her own movies, she's been trying to understand what's working in theaters versus how fully streaming is taking control. "I spend a lot of time trying to unlock it. Fellow actors that are also producing think about this too. Hemsworth and I talk about it a lot," she says, meaning Chris, of course. "But people often forget that it's a business. Even creatives forget that it's a business. Johansson does not. She's thoughtful, but practical. And judging from following her around Manhattan a little while, she's got a pretty good sense of direction." Shadows in the Valley, From the Steel Belt to Steve Bannon's Realms, California Congressman Ro Khanna has stumped his way down the Democrats' road of death. Can his specific brand of progressive populism bring it back to life? By Joe Hagan, with opening illustration by Chris Buzzelli, which shows Khanna in the foreground wearing a suit, and in the background all sorts of American scenes, from the industrial to the small town. And in a photo, the view from the author's Washington, D.C. hotel window on Inauguration Day. The day after Donald Trump becomes president of the United States for the second time, I'm in a cramped booth in the back of Pete's Diner, a greasy spoon in Washington, D.C., experiencing the slow onset shock of a world turned to absolute shit. The future is a gaping void, the past a mushroom cloud. I've spent the previous morning in the bitter cold, fording rivers of guffawing frat boys, MAGA-hatted blondes in teetering heels, gaggles of acid-washed biker retirees, and street merchants hawking bootleg Trump T-shirts by the hundreds. In the distance, a man carols incessantly, "They're eating the dogs! They're eating the cats!" In despair, I look across the table for a shred of hope, and find the 48-year-old Democrat of the 17th Congressional District of California, Ro Khanna, nursing a weak cup of coffee as a 14-degree breeze blows through the jangling front door, stirring a flake of dandruff on Khanna's rumpled blue suit. 24 hours earlier, Khanna had watched Trump take the oath of office in front of Abraham Lincoln's Bible. His eye fell on the figure of Barack Obama, one of Khanna's political heroes, whom he'd first campaigned for as a college student in 1996, now a shrunken idol from a bygone era. "I thought that when he won in 2008, he had centered a new generation," Khanna laments, "a multiracial America, a vision of new dynamic leaders. And seeing him on the side of that stage, almost as a figure pushed aside, and watching Trump centered was disheartening." "Obama," Khanna says, "was the protagonist in my story." Today, Khanna's professional obligation in this blizzard of shit is to shovel cheerfully. And Khanna is nothing if not professional. "I mean, this is an opportunity for rebirth," he insists. "Crisis is a time for renewal, revitalization, new leadership. And I think that that is the opportunity we have as Democrats." From the vantage of Tuesday, January 21st, this opportunity is downright laughable. And in the weeks ahead, as Democratic leaders jaw empty platitudes like animatronic figures in a museum to their dead party, it won't get much funnier. For Khanna, the moment offers personal opportunity, the long, lonely chance to present himself as a new Democratic hope, jostling for attention with Gavin Newsom, John Fetterman, Chris Murphy, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and a bunch of other strivers on TikTok, podcast, op-ed columns, and cable TV in the jump ball for the party's future. Khanna's version of what went wrong will soon become conventional wisdom. "Democrats went too far on social issues, putting the DEI cart before the economic horse. Joe Biden clung to power too long, and Kamala Harris ran a weak campaign short on vision," he tells me. "Trump," he will conclude, "did the party a favor by delegitimizing its failed leadership. There is no Democratic Party leader," he observes. "Who's the leader? There's got to be a ferocious battle with the establishment. This is not kumbaya, let's all get along. This is you screwed up and you betrayed the voters." A desperate situation. To his credit, Khanna has been preparing for this moment for years, doggedly selling a left-wing answer to MAGA populism that he has dubbed progressive capitalism, or more recently, economic patriotism, or sometimes half-jokingly, blue MAGA. Since 2016, Khanna has made repeated visits to MAGA districts like Warren, Ohio, and Johnstown, Pennsylvania, to field test his big idea, investing billions of federal dollars in American tech and steel companies to build new factories and create jobs in middle America without trade wars and demagoguery. Democrats, Khanna argues, need to offer a bold economic transformation of rebuilding this country, rebuilding our industrial base, using technology to have massive advances in society. Those are all things that we didn't do, and we didn't have a policy. We didn't have the grand vision. Khanna is an unlikely populist. His California district covers Silicon Valley and includes many of the most powerful tech companies in the world, including Apple and NVIDIA. As Democrat's self-styled tech whisperer, he advertises his friendships with Elon Musk and Mark Andreessen, and breaks with party orthodoxy on issues important to tech bros like free speech, the civic value of X.com, the right of TikTok to operate in the U.S., and the virtues of Bitcoin. At Pete's Diner, he offers a generous interpretation of Musk sure seemed like a Nazi salute at a Trump rally. It's a combination of making clear that any gesture like that is something to be avoided, says Khanna, a trained lawyer, while also giving people the benefit of the doubt about what they're saying they're doing. Khanna has unlikely fans on the right, most famously Steve Bannon, one of Trumpism's primary architects, who singles Khanna out as a favorite Democrat who speaks the same populist language that he does. Man, what an uphill fight he's got, Bannon said on his War Room podcast after Khanna became the sole Democrat to stand up and applaud when Trump spotlighted a 13-year-old boy with brain cancer during a congressional speech in March. The Friday after we meet at the diner, Khanna appears on Real Time with Bill Maher and gets steamrolled by the splenetic E-SPAN host Stephen A. Smith, who excoriates Democrats as out of touch and unable to compete in the spectacle-style politics of the Trump age. Khanna counters, "Do we have to have the celebrity president? Is it all about coolness?" Maher practically laughs him out of the studio. "That horse has left the barn," he says sourly. For Khanna and every other Democrat, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. As another icy breeze blows through the door, Khanna welcomes me on a listening tour of Western Pennsylvania and Milwaukee, where he will meet disenfranchised workers and sell his big idea for bringing factories and jobs back to the Rust Belt, and hope they forget for a minute that he believes in trans rights and DEI. "We've got to listen and persuade," Khanna tells me, and those are the two tenets of the rebirth of the modern Democratic Party. And I will ride along with Khanna through the valley of the shadow of political death. Next photo, Representative Ro Khanna on the road to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, from Pittsburgh. I first met Khanna 2 years ago in Fremont, California, where one evening over a plate of biryani, he explained his big idea. That year, he co-sponsored the CHIPS and Science Act, a bill conceived under the first Trump administration, but passed with bipartisan support and signed by President Joe Biden. The plan would seed Intel with almost $8 billion to build chip factories in Arizona, New Mexico, Ohio, and Oregon instead of importing chips from Taiwan. Khanna showcased the CHIPS Act in his 2022 book, Progressive Capitalism, How to Make Tech Work for All of Us. At the time, Khanna was critical of Governor Newsom, who was advertising California as the left-wing answer to Governor Ron DeSantis's free state of Florida, which Kana found tone-deaf. Kana took an intriguing stance. Rather than billboarding California as a liberal Shangri-La, which it most assuredly was not, Democrats should show more humility and focus on economic prosperity for the heartland. It's insensitive to the unique traditions, assets, and skills of people in other parts of the nation, he said, of Newsom's California ballyhooing. When I go to my wife's hometown in Cleveland, if the Browns lose, people are depressed through Wednesday. They're literally depressed. There's a different level of attachment to place. I think that it comes off as out of touch to say that the whole nation should be California. Kana later told me Newsom was unhappy with his critiques in Vanity Fair for that story titled, Can Anyone Fix California? Now, on a Tuesday afternoon in late January, Kana's aide shuttles Kana and me in a rented Jeep Compass along a Pennsylvania highway dotted with Trump signs, drooping American flags, gigantic roadside crucifixes, rusted-out bridges, and the grim visage of an abandoned steel mill on a leafless winter horizon. I point to a pickup truck with a 1776 sticker on the back of the cab. Democrats have been accused of saying that 1619 is when the country started, which is a little misreading, muses Kana, who is wearing the D.C. uniform of navy blue suit and crisp white shirt. From 1965 to 2025, he says, the story of America was the story of ever-growing diversity and pluralism. But people, Democrats, took it for granted. If there is an assertion of nationalism, hearkening back to a nostalgic past, wouldn't you expect it, he says? I mean, were we just expecting that we just kind of sleep our way into becoming this perfect multiracial democracy and everyone would just applaud? Johnstown, Pennsylvania, was a thriving steel town until the mills moved to China in the 1980s. The population plummeted, and now the city is plagued by unemployment, low wages, and full-throated MAGA enthusiasm. Walmart has become the big employer. Last year, Kana co-sponsored the Modern Steel Act, which proposed to build next-generation steel plants here, complete with unions, to revive the town's fortunes. At a Trump rally last August, local business leader and Trump donor Bill Polachek, whose manufacturing company thrives on contracts with the U.S. government, railed against the idea, labeling it green steel to put the climate change hex on it. 2 months ago, we had a far-left liberal, a U.S. representative from Congress, Ro Khanna, that came to our conservative town touting green steel, he yelled. That's bullshit. Who the hell brought this far-left liberal from California to our town? At least they were paying attention. Voter turnout in Johnstown reached 81% in 2024, the vast majority going to Trump. Hope for Kana's steel bill faded to black. That evening, Kana and I drive to nearby Red's Texas Barbecue, a fluorescent-lit restaurant lined with gambling machines and a coin-operated claw game with a rubber Trump head inside. His ghoulish likeness is mashed against the plexiglass. As the co-owner, Tracy, takes Kana's order for a rack of ribs, her husband, Jimmy, comes by to ask if he's a doctor, perhaps mistaking him for Sanjay Gupta from CNN. Kana identifies himself as a congressman from California and leaps to defuse any embarrassment. That's a very good thing, Kana says cheerfully. Indian Americans, when you go to different places, people think they could be a doctor, which is a positive impression. He tells the couple he's in town to investigate opening a new steel plant. Do you think that would help? Yes, Tracy says emphatically. We need one. People need jobs. There's not much left here. Kana says a new steel plant would help businesses like hers. Tracy says Kana faces an uphill battle. The thought process of people in Johnstown is if it's not directly helping them, they don't want nothing to do with it, she laments. This town is so stagnant. People are just okay with being okay. Kana asks for her best solution for bringing jobs back to Johnstown. Casino, she says flatly. In the mall, adds Jimmy. The gambling games blare in the background. But a steel plant would help, Kana asks, hopefully. Steel mill, a casino, some kind of water park, says Tracy. That would be huge, says Jimmy. He enthusiastically describes a successful water park in a nearby town. Kana gingerly wades into politics, asking what people hope Trump will do for them. Not what he's doing right now, Tracy says. Kana's eyes light up. Over the weekend, the administration temporarily freezes federal funds, making the Medicaid payment system temporarily inaccessible across many states, spurring panic. Tracy's mother, we learn, is in the hospital with stage 4 cancer, and if she doesn't have Medicare and Medicaid, she'll have to sell everything she owns. Her cost of living, which includes her late husband's leftover debt, leaves her with $19 to spare each month. And that's if she follows a strict budget and doesn't stop for a coffee or McDonald's, Tracy says. Tracy says she absolutely voted for Trump. I'm not sad that I did, and is looking forward to when he makes good on his no tax on tips promise. Waiters in the area make $2.83 an hour plus tips, she says, and barely eke out a living. Still, Trump is an imperfect instrument. He doesn't know how it feels to not be able to feed your family, she says, suggesting that Trump could mail out another round of stimulus checks to poor people, as he did during the pandemic, to get a car, to get a job. Here's $5,000, get yourself some furniture. Will it happen? Probably not. Kana asked whether she considered voting for Vice President Kamala Harris. And Tracy says she was intrigued, but found Harris phony. I'm a pretty good judge of character, she assures us. How phony do you think I am? Asks Kana, to laughter all around. Really, honestly, good luck, she tells him. We climb back into the compass, and Kana reviews what we've learned. Their eyes lit up with the steel. Did you see that? He says. You saw what it meant, people in this community. Tracy seemed more excited by the casino, I reply. Yeah, that was sad, he acknowledges. The whole exchange illustrates, Kana believes, how Harris's campaign message in 2024 was disconnected from working people. Instead of talking to the likes of Tracy, he says, Kamala Harris was talking about opportunity society so people can start startups. Like, does Tracy care about starting a startup? I mean, come on. Kana says Tracy's story proves that only 8 days into Trump's presidency, Democrats are already finding political openings. She didn't bring up trans rights, he says. She didn't bring up LGBTQ rights. She didn't bring up, oh, I don't like what they're teaching in our schools. The more Kana thinks about it, the more he sees the proprietor of Red's Texas Barbecue as a political bellwether. She shows why this country is absolutely winnable, he says. We just didn't run a good campaign, or she would have voted for Kamala. And I'm sure there are thousands of people like her. It reaffirms my faith in the country. That's a voter we can easily win in 26 and 28 with the right message. It's not that voters were wrong. We did something wrong. Next photos, a coin-operated claw game in Red's Texas Barbecue. And Kana, who befriended the owners of Red's Texas Barbecue, and they voted for Trump. The next morning, Trump suggests DEI is to blame for a fatal plane crash over the Potomac in Washington as Kana and I don hard hats and lab coats to tour a factory of Hoganis. A Swedish company that produces metallurgical powders for manufacturing. The staff is largely white and working class, a rare union shop in a region of low-paying service jobs. An entry-level job at Hoganis pays about $24 an hour, plus health care and a pension. Across town, The company operated by Trump donor Bill Polachek, who has broken at least two unionization attempts and festoons his warehouses with signs that say God, faith, and country, reportedly pays some $18 an hour to entry-level welders. Turnover is rampant there, and Trump is wildly popular. But Hoganess is no different. Union officials estimate that around 80% of the company's rank and file voted for Trump. The higher-ups argue politics with them every day. When they try debating staffers over Trump's lies, they just get angry with you, says Gerald Lee, recording secretary for USW Local 2632. Joe Rogan is the common source of news. His podcast runs heavy in this area, Lee says. Next photos, Kana and the author tour Hoganess with factory management and union officials. And State Representative Frank Burns and Kana at Lamb Cakes Bakery in Johnstown for a luncheon with local workers. Trump's prolonged attack on transgender people worked in Johnstown, as it did across all of the Midwestern states, formerly known as the Blue Wall. We still have employees that think a bearded lady in a sundress is going to walk into the girls' bathroom, says Lee. Democratic State Representative Frank Burns, or far-left Frank, as some locals call him, says people feared that droves of immigrants would show up and work for less than $18 an hour and steal their jobs. Johnstown has almost no immigrants. You factor in the cultural stuff on top of that, the transsexual stuff in sports, Burns says, it's just beyond the comprehension of the average person. Like, where are we going as a country? At a luncheon afterward, Kana meets with local union leaders in a dreary cafe across from a park where drug addicts gather at night. Baseball-hatted dudes from the International Association of Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers and the Iron Workers Local Union No. 3 receive the Yale-educated Democrat from California with curiosity and politeness, maybe a touch of awe, because he's on TV a lot. I represent Silicon Valley, begins Kana's pitch, and I've been passionate about figuring out how we reindustrialize our country. The reality, as all of you know, is for the last 50 years, we basically had industry after industry shift offshore. We lost steel. You guys know more than I do that we've made in western Pennsylvania more steel than Japan and Germany combined. We lost aluminum. We lost shipbuilding. We don't make enough of the drugs that we buy at CVS or Walgreens. A lot of the pill manufacturing has gone offshore. China announced last week that they have a $4 trillion trade surplus. That means they're selling $1 trillion more to places like the United States, and we're buying from them while the jobs are there. Now, in my district, he continues, we've got $12 trillion of wealth and technology. Google, Apple, NVIDIA, a lot of the new tech companies. But you can't build a nation without manufacturing. You can't be a strong country and a secure country without a strong industrial base. So I call it a new economic patriotism. Kana pivots to the tale of Tracy, whose restaurant everyone is familiar with, asking why her ailing mother barely scrapes by every month in a country where we're producing $12 trillion in one district. The big idea laid out, Kana acknowledges an obvious problem. The tech companies, all my guys, he says, were lined up beside Trump only days earlier. Would they be willing to come to Johnstown? A woman asks hopefully. I'm trying, replies Kana, reminding them that under the Obama administration, Musk took a $465 million federal loan to support a Tesla plant in Fremont, California, and the administration failed to demand labor neutrality as part of the deal, which would have allowed for unions. Despite what everyone may have heard on Fox News, Kana says, the government is not the enemy. 50 years we've been hearing that, he says, growing stern. Let me just be blunt. We're arguing about what's going to happen with trans kids. We're arguing about deporting criminals. All BS. All BS in terms of whether we're going to beat China or not. It all sounds good on paper. Another union official wonders how Khanna plans to slow Trump's bulldozing of D.C., which appears on day 8 unstoppable. Khanna attempts spine-straightening rhetoric. We had people in this country scale the cliffs of Normandy, he says, pacing. We had John Lewis beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We had people who have sacrificed so much for 250 years of American democracy. We're not going to lose democracy for one person named Donald Trump. I have more confidence in the American public. Khanna hangs his hopes on Tracy. That confidence was restored last night when I talked to Tracy, Khanna says. She voted for Trump, but these cuts to Medicare, she said, it's not why I voted for him. I voted for him because I didn't want a tax on tips. I voted for him because the Democratic Party has ignored rural America for too long. I didn't think he was going to stop the basic services on which we depend. Bowing to public pressure, the government rescinds the freeze, and within 48 hours, the Medicaid system switches back on. What does that tell me, asked Khanna, that when people in this country speak out, we still have an enormous amount of power? Here's the good news, Khanna concludes. Trump is a lame duck. In 2 years, we're going to start running for the future. Khanna and I sat down to a buffet of soggy hamburgers and fries. At the start of our tour, Khanna makes the bold prediction that Trump will be a footnote in American history. He's a passing moment in the American story that will be footnoted with a little deeper footnote, he told me. Now, he's going to be Andrew Jackson instead of just inconsequential, but that's not the American narrative. Trump's talk of American revival is appealing, Khanna admits, an echo of John F. Kennedy and Obama. But I think he's linking all of that with his MAGA base, which wants to move back to an America prior to the 1965 Immigration Act, which allowed my parents to come to the United States. That America, he is quick to note, excludes me. Khanna faces rooms of working-class white men with admirable courage. It helps that he talks in the nasal lilt of a native Pennsylvanian, his flattened vowels lending an air of approachability. He sells his biography as evidence of his essential Americanness. His father, a chemical engineer, and mother, a substitute teacher, moved to the States from Punjab, India in the 1970s and raised Khanna in suburban Bucks County. He played Little League baseball, poorly, he says, and became valedictorian at his high school, class of 1994. He jumped on the conveyor belt to success. An economics degree from the University of Chicago, a law degree from Yale, a clerkship with a judge in Arkansas, a move to Silicon Valley in 2003, where he landed at Munger, Tollis, and Olson, focusing on litigation. In 2004, he quit to work for John Kerry's campaign and to run for California's 12th congressional district on an anti-war platform against incumbent Tom Lantos, a Holocaust survivor. He lost by 46 points. Khanna's defining moment arrived in 2009. He was teaching economics at Stanford when Nancy Pelosi recommended him for a job in the Obama administration. Khanna imagined himself jetting to Brussels and focusing on international trade as head of the Commerce Department. Instead, he was assigned domestic policy and got a grand tour of Warren, Ohio. His aha moment was when he heard about 13 people in Warren who had taken their own lives in the wake of factory closings. It had an emotional impact, he says to me. In 2012, Khanna wrote his first book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future, and reached out to a rising tech pioneer for a blurb. Elon Musk followed through, calling Khanna a leading thinker. The unconventional ideas in this book chart the path America can take to lead the world for years to come, enthused the man who was now hacking the federal government. Khanna says he recognized Musk's role in the electric vehicle revolution and wanted to see how we not lose him as part of the Democratic coalition, he recalls. And he knew I disagreed with him on labor issues, but we would have conversations. In 2014, Khanna ran for office again, this time in the 17th District of California, against incumbent Democrat Mike Honda. Pelosi backed Honda in the primary, and Khanna lost again. A friend of Khanna's put it to him straight. He says, look, you're almost 40 years old, you're not married, you're in debt, you've lost twice, Khanna recalls. What are you going to do with your life? That was a wake-up call. For years, Khanna had been dating a woman named Ritu Ahuja, the daughter of a successful Indian-American automotive parts supplier from Northeast Ohio. She was glamorous, a Georgetown grad with a master's degree in strategic communications from Columbia. In 2015, Ahuja made one of her few campaign appearances as a political partner when she stood on a stage at a campaign stop in Santa Clara and recalled Khanna's entreaties to marry him while dating on and off for 8 years. She had rejected him twice, but finally said yes on the cusp of Khanna's third run for Congress against Honda again. She compared her fiancé's dogged romantic efforts to his political career. Truly, the man does not give up when something matters to him, she said. Khanna initially supported Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee in 2016, but shocked his own campaign staff by switching mid-primary to Bernie Sanders. Some congressional colleagues viewed Khanna as an opportunist, but Khanna says he realized that he, like Sanders, was an outsider in the party. Pelosi had endorsed Honda against him again, making clear Khanna wasn't part of the club in California and the machine politics. Bernie was just this outsider who was taking on the system, saying you've got to make way for more voices, he says. That was the emotional draw, and his advocacy for Medicare for All, which I was supporting. Khanna ran to the left of Honda and won the congressional seat. Subsequently, Sanders became Khanna's mentor, later asking Khanna to co-chair his 2020 presidential campaign. Had it not been for the fateful job at Commerce and meeting Sanders, says Khanna, my life could have easily gone a different way, into me being a guy who would have just been a voice for globalization and tech wealth. Khanna thinks of himself as a progressive's answer to J.D. Vance. An ambitious and intellectual outsider from a marginalized background who earned a law degree from Yale, migrated to Silicon Valley to seek his financial and political fortune, and authored books to help define his public profile. Though Vance's book sold vastly more copies. We followed each other for many years, he says of Vance. We've both seen the pinnacles of Silicon Valley, and he's drawn from that techno-libertarianism of tearing down government up by the bootstraps. Mine is much more focused on a fair social compact. Government needs to have a role in providing people with health care and education, so we've taken very different visions of the kind of America we want. The two first met at a tech conference hosted by AOL co-founder Steve Case, and later went on a bus tour of Ohio alongside then-Representative Tim Ryan. The New York Times dubbed it a Rust Belt safari. Khanna and Ahuja both know Usha Vance, who had also worked at Munger, Tallis, and Olson. When the Vances first moved to Washington, Usha and Ritu connected to talk about life in the Beltway. I ask Khanna, what must an educated second-generation Indian-American woman think of her white husband's immigrant bashing? Khanna, citing personal civility, sidesteps the question and turns the hose on J.D. I think his 22-year-old self, the J.D. Vance who was at Yale Law School and who married Usha Vance, would be horrified, he says. What would he think of what J.D. Vance has become? He's obviously not George Wallace, but I think about George Wallace and how he adopted certain positions because of pure political opportunism, not because of ideology, continues Khanna, referring to the racist demagogue and Alabama governor who ran for president multiple times in the 1960s and 70s. What Vance said about cat ladies and the role of women in American society, saying Haitian immigrants are eating cats and dogs, the willingness to instill fear and division for the sake of power is a pretty unoriginal tale. It's a pretty tried and true way of advancing yourself, and he's doing that. In February, Khanna called out Vance for defending a Doge staffer who had resigned after a racist post about Indian immigrants came to light. Are you going to tell him to apologize for saying normalize Indian hate before this rehire? Khanna tweeted at Vance, just asking for the sake of both of our kids. Khanna drew an angry rebuke from Vance. For the sake of both of our kids, grow up, Vance shot back. Racist trolls on the internet, while offensive, don't threaten my kids. You know what does? A culture that denies grace to people who make mistakes. A culture that encourages congressmen to act like whiny children. I cannot overstate how much I loathe this emotional blackmail pretending to be concerned, Vance added. Sensing he'd hit a nerve, Khanna scheduled a big speech for April, defense of the Constitution and university, choosing Yale Law School as the backdrop against which to road test some soaring rhetoric and take pot shots at a certain elegiac hillbilly, comparing him to other historical monsters. As Stephen Kotkin observed in his study of Stalin, said Khanna, strong men do not fear recessions or even failed wars as much as they fear the university. Yawn, a Vance spokesman responded in the press. Khanna is not a natural pugilist. When I suggest he might be too mild-mannered for this gig, Khanna gets defensive, invoking his maternal grandfather, Amarnath Vidyalankar, who fought for Indian independence alongside Mahatma Gandhi and was imprisoned for 2 years. Khanna says he comes from a maverick legacy. I don't have to walk in and suck up all the oxygen, he tells me. I can listen. People often describe me as a listener, right? Maybe after the bombast, the ugliness of what's going on, the simple chance of embodying American decency and kindness and empathy and listening and substance, which is also a strain in the American story, right? For every Donald Trump character, there are also those characters. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.